Today at Reader's Corner, Wade Davis, author of Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest.
Every other account of these early expeditions has presented the expeditions as if they existed outside of time, history, and culture. And, of course, that's not the case. Everest has always been this touchstone by which you can measure the height and the depth and the final breakup of the British Empire. These were men who were so confident in their masculinity that they could speak of love between men without shame. They could pluck butterflies in the early morning. They could discuss Shakespeare and Keats and Shelley over lunch and still be prepared to assault the German lines or indeed to assault the flanks of Everest by dusk.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Today's mountaineers tackle the world's tallest peaks with the latest in technical gear, from down suits to nylon ropes and even cell phones. It's a far cry from the 1920s, when the first intrepid mountaineers to attempt Mount Everest climbed in hobnail boots, hauled heavy canvas tents, and were literally facing the unknown. Today's guest, Wade Davis, tells the thrilling story of early British attempts to reach the roof of the world in his book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. At the center of his narrative is George Mallory, the legendary climber who on June 6, 1924, set out with his young companion from a camp perched at 23,000 feet and never returned. Dr. Davis spent more than 10 years researching Into the Silence, which moves well beyond the details of the actual climbs to explore how the Great War, Britain's imperial ambitions, and a search for redemption shaped a generation. Wade Davis is the National Geographic Society's Explorer in Residence. He holds degrees from Harvard University, including a Ph.D. in ethnobotany, and he is the author of more than 200 scientific and popular articles and 17 books. Into the Silence received the 2012 Samuel Johnson Prize, the United Kingdom's top prize for nonfiction. Dr. Davis joins us by phone from Northern British Columbia for this interview. Wade Davis, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thanks, Bob, for that wonderful introduction.
Well, Wade, getting a hold of you was half the fun, in the sense of learning that you're in northern British Columbia. Tell us what you're doing up there at this point.
I live in northern British Columbia in the summer times. I own a fishing lodge up here, and it's the kind of place where, you know, we as Canadians could throw England and the English would never find it. And just this morning when I got up, we just had this cinnamon black bear that's been hanging around for a couple of years, but she had a little couple cubs, and she just kind of got a little too friendly this morning, so I just had to fire off a couple of rounds and make her dance a bit so she'd go away.
So I assume she was just looking for some food?
Yeah, there's so many bears up here, you kind of stumble over them, you know, and she's a nice bear, but you know how it goes.
Right. They're even nicer when they're at a distance. So you're an explorer in residence for the National Geographic Society. What does that entail? I mean, that sounds like a great job.
Well, I'm not the only one. I mean, there's now, I think, 14 of us. It's a wonderful program, and it really began, I was part of the first sort of class of seven back almost 15 years ago when the Society entered its second century, and it really was wanted to sort of demonstrate to the world that it not just didn't just report science, but it generated science. And so it recruited, as part of its new conservation mission, seven individuals that, in a sense, were seen to personify that mission. So we had Jane Goodall for primatology and Sylvia Earle, the great oceanographer, for ocean conservation, Bob Ballard, who found the Titanic. And I was very lucky to be recruited as sort of the social anthropologist, really with the mission to celebrate the wonder of culture around the world and draw people's attention to the really disturbing fact that half the languages of the world are not being taught to children. Mm-hmm. And the program's grown over the years, and the latest remarkable addition to this kind of wonderful cadre of friends is Jim Cameron, who, of course, did the film Titanic and Avatar.
Yes.
And he's a very serious underwater explorer. He just went down to the deepest part of the Marianas Trench a year or so ago, and so he's a wonderful addition to our group.
So you've written this definitive account of mountaineering and the Everest climbs of the 1920s. Have you flirted with mountaineering yourself?
Oh, yeah. I grew up climbing mountains in Canada. You know, it's interesting, in your introduction, you mentioned the fundamental story and that's haunted mountaineers in Britain in particular, but all over the world since that fateful day in June of 1924. And the question has always been, did Mallory get to the top before he and young Sandy Irvin succumbed? From the beginning of this project, I was never really interested, Bob, in that question. What I wanted to know is, who were these men who walked aloft in that distant era, a time when, frankly, to attempt to go to the top of Everest was equivalent to trying to go to the moon? And what interested me was, who were these men? Because I knew that just from their age and their class, all of them, by definition, would have gone through the agony of the Western Front. And my intuition, which really did play out, was that I was never suggesting that they were cavalier about death, but they would have seen so much of death in the war that it had no mystery to them. It had nothing more to teach them save that of their own. And it perhaps encouraged them to accept a level of risk that might have been unimaginable before the war.
What were you able to find out about these 26 men who were part of the three Everest expeditions?
I was actually able to find out where each man was every single day of the Great War. And that may seem to have been an impossible task. But the funny thing about that war, the terrible thing about that war, I suppose, is it was so completely chronicled that it's a wonder men found time to fight. And the British zone of operations was surprisingly small. The British frontage was never longer than 125 miles. Much of the war was only 85 miles. Now, behind that front, the British would build 6,000 miles of trenches, 6,000 miles of railroad. In the salient around the old medieval cloth town in Belgium of Ypres, an area just 4 miles by 12 miles, 1.7 million boys would die during that carnage. And because the zone of operations was so small, and because so many millions of men had gone through it, and because in the wake of the war, a decade later, there was this kind of cathartic tsunami of publications, of journals and letters and diaries and regimental accounts. So not only could I find out where the men had been, but with a level of accuracy and specificity that would have been unimaginable to me before the beginning of the research, I was able to really ascertain what they would have been exposed to. And, you know, we forget, particularly as Americans, we think of the Second World War as sort of the crucible of the 20th century. But in a way, as Churchill famously said, the Second World War was but the child of the first. He called it the 30 Years' War. He famously said, never was there a war less necessary to fight than the first, or more essential to win than the second. And everything we know about being modern, in a sense, comes out of that crucible of history.
Britain suffered tremendous losses during the Great War. Can you talk about the toll this placed on the nation?
What the British went through is just beyond imagining. I mean, just think about a couple of things. Cremation, for example, was virtually unknown as a way of dealing with the dead in the British Empire before the war. But in the wake of 4 years and 4 months of living with rotten flesh in no man's land, it became the preferred way of dealing with the dead for countless thousands in the wake of the war. Just think of the fact that in the entire Iraq and Afghanistan wars of the last decade, we have yet to lose 10,000 soldiers in combat. Every month for the 4 years and 4 months of the Great War, the British required 10,000 junior officers just to replace the litany of the dead, just young lieutenants. And so schools like Charterhouse, where Mallory taught, and Winchester, where he went to school, or Marlborough, or Eton, or Harrow, all these famous schools literally graduated their senior classes not to Oxford or Cambridge, but directly to the front lines. And so the rate of mortality was simply incredible. And 35% of the boys died from machine gun fire or rifle fire, but 65% simply died clinging in terror to the side of a mud trench as a rain of shells and iron and fire came down upon them from above. In World War I, it was not uncommon for each side on a single day to exchange a million high artillery shells. And so the cost bled white the country financially, and the agonies bled white the young boys. And so if on the eve of the war, if the attempt to climb Mount Everest was, in a sense, a gesture of redemption for an empire of explorers who had famously lost the race to the North and South Poles, and Everest kind of emerged as the third pole looming above the frontier of the Raj, in the wake of the war, the effort to climb Everest became a mission of regeneration for an entire nation and generation bled white by the conflict.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Wade Davis. He's the author of Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Could you go so far as to say that were it not for their experiences in the Great War, the 1920s expeditions in Everest wouldn't have happened?
No, I don't think you can say that. I mean, the British were all, you know, intrepid explorers. I mean, you know, you only have to look at the Shackleton expedition to Antarctica, you know, which literally was sailing forth from Britain on the day that war was declared, and Shackleton famously communicated through, you know, the Navy, should we continue with this expedition? And Churchill, who was First Lord of the Admiralty, famously said, "Sail on for Britannia." So, I mean, the British were intrepid explorers before the war, and I try very hard in the book not to editorialize. I never say, you know, the war did this, so therefore they did that. What I was trying to suggest was that every other account of these early expeditions has either presented the men almost as stick figures in support of the legendary George Mallory, or presented the expeditions as if they existed outside of time, history, and culture. And, of course, that's not the case. And what I try to do with the war is simply to say that if you really want to understand who these 26 men were, given that many of them were in their 20s and early 30s, how could you possibly understand who they were without acknowledging what they had endured over 4 years and 4 months of the Great
Right.
War?
So who was George Mallory?
Well, Mallory, ironically, although he sort of hogged the attention on all these expeditions, was in many ways not the most interesting of the individuals on these climbs. I mean, George Mallory was, his fame, no doubt, came about because, of course, he did disappear in this mysterious way. And he also was stunningly good-looking. He was, of course, the greatest rock climber. He was the only climber who had been on all three of the expeditions. He was the individual who the Everest Committee sort of highlighted as a symbol of the expedition. So he became sort of the point person for the expeditions.
He also uttered the famous quote.
Well, you know, and it's a great point, Bob, because it's inscribed, you know, in schools all over Britain now. You know, he was asked why do you climb Everest, and he responded, because it's there, and that became iconic. And what's fascinating is that quote does in fact distill something of the pure essence of their desire. But he actually uttered that quote to a journalist in New York on a lecture tour in 1923 at the end of a long talk, and as one of his colleagues said, Mallory is probably just trying to get rid of a bothersome journalist who stood between him and a good drink at a speakeasy, you know, because, but it became this iconic distillation of those expeditions.
The team traveled through Tibet to reach Everest. Why that route?
You could not go to Everest from the south because the Nepalese refused any intrusion into their territory, and the British Raj was not about to pressure them for something as inconsequential as a mountain climb. And so the only way to approach it was through Tibet, but to get permission from the 13th Dalai Lama turns out to have been an element of a very complex diplomatic initiative that it was essentially an arms deal upon which the future of a free Tibet hung. And so the expeditions were very much part of that era in the Raj.
Mallory may have been the most famous climber, but he wasn't the only one with an interesting story. Who else was on the team?
This is one of the reasons it's so interesting, this story, because you see these photographs of these characters dressed in their tweeds, you know, in Darjeeling in 1921, and they look almost mousy in their dress and so on. You can't imagine they're about to walk 500 miles off the map, but then you scratch the surface of the characters and you realize you've got a guy like Sandy Wollaston, who was the naturalist and the physician on the expedition in 21, and previously he had, on 12 hours' notice, responded to an advertisement in the London Times for a naturalist to join an expedition to the mountains of the moon in Uganda. He had sailed 3 months simply to catch up with the expedition, spent 9 months in the jungle collecting plants, and then when it came time to return to England, he thought, what the heck, why go back the same way? So he walked from the source of the Congo to the mouth, becoming the second man since Stanley to do it. You know, and that's a typical of the character of these individuals. Howard Bury, who was the expedition leader in 1921, stained his skin with walnut juice, slipped into Tibet, you know, walked the length of the Ganges naked, adorned with scented oils, killing a man-eating tiger that had run off with 24 holy men. He later was, on the eve of the Great War, was exploring the mountains of heaven in Central Asia. He befriended a Asiatic bear that he nicknamed Agu, and as Asiatic bears tend to do, Agu got very big, and his favorite form of exercise back at his estate in Belvedere in Ireland was to strip himself naked and wrestle with this massive Asiatic bear beneath the willow arbor of his mansion. I mean, it just goes on and on. So one of the things I really, really was drawn to these men is that they're a kind of man that will never exist again, and yet they were our grandfathers. And what I mean by that is, you know, these were men of the 19th century. These were men who were not prepared to yield their feelings to analysis. They were not prepared to litter the world with themselves. This is a pre-celebrity culture. And yet these were men who were so confident in their masculinity that they could speak of love between men without shame. They could draw watercolors in the dawn. They could collect butterflies in the early morning. They could discuss Shakespeare and Keats and Shelley over lunch and still be prepared to assault the German lines or indeed to assault the flanks of Everest by dusk. I mean, this is a kind of man that we'll never know again.
How different was the landscape that they discovered for the first time in the 1920s compared to the landscape that climbers find today in the Himalaya? And I'm thinking of all the stories I've heard of how junked up the place has become.
Well, I mean, you know, Everest is unique in that regard. I mean, you know, Everest is not nearly as technical and challenging a mountain as K2 or any of the other great 8,000-meter peaks in the Himalaya. And there are obviously very difficult faces on Everest, the notorious West Ridge, the astonishing Kenshin face on the east face of Everest, where you stand on ground higher than anything in North America, and you look up at two vertical miles of ice rising to the South Col. And these are routes that can only be attempted by the very best of climbers. But the standard routes in Everest from the south, the route that Hillary took in 1953 when he finally summited the mountain up through Nepal through to the Khumbu ice field, up the western Khumbu to the South Col, and the route through Tibet, which is a route that the British pioneered in 1921, both of those routes have really only a single impediment. And so climbing Everest by those routes is less an issue of technical skills with a rope than physical endurance, acclimatization, good luck with the weather, and so on. And yet both of those routes do have one technical impediment, the legendary Hillary step on the south route and the second step on the northeast ridge of the northern Tibetan route. And that's why people get into such trouble, because when you have hundreds of people climbing the mountain, as you do now, it creates a logjam at that impediment. So literally you have individuals, sometimes dozens and dozens of people, waiting their place in queue to attempt to go up or down these impediments. And as they're waiting there, of course, are in the death zone, where oxygen deprivation alone causes deterioration of the faculties by the minute. So this is why it's become such a kind of a mess on Everest every spring, and why people sadly die every spring.
Well, the other issue, and we've touched on it here, but I still can't believe it, when you describe the way these guys are dressed, Norfolk jackets and knickerbockers, I don't understand. Even today you hear stories with all the Gore-Tex and all the protection you have from the elements. You hear stories of these folks getting frostbite and losing limbs and fingers and toes.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about Everest is that, you know, as Howard Bury, the head of the 1921 reconnaissance expedition, famously said, that the challenge of Everest is that the lower half of your body can be suffering from frostbite while the upper half is suffering from heat stroke. So it's a bit of a myth that the early Brits were poorly equipped. I mean, they had the best equipment of their era. There had been a lot of work done on the polar expeditions. George Finch, one of the most interesting characters in 1922, literally invented the down jacket for the Everest expeditions. He invented the kind of anorak for the expeditions. They understood dressing in layers and silk and wool. So it wasn't that as much as, I think that the single most challenging thing is that crampons had been invented, but the crampons that they had tended to cause frostbite at high elevation. You know, when we ask the obvious question, you know, did Mallory get to the top before he succumbed? Conrad Anker, who actually found Mallory's body in 1999, then retraced the route to the top. And Conrad's probably one of our greatest alpine climbers today. He's a wonderful fellow, and he's a good friend of mine. And I've talked a lot with Conrad about that. And, you know, he in his initial account of his climb, definitely came to the conclusion that Mallory could not have made it.
Why was Conrad Anker so certain Mallory had failed the summit?
we know that Conrad, on his final assault with Dave Hahn, left their camp at 2 in the morning and did not get back till 9 p.m. We know that in Mallory's final tent, he left his torch, suggesting the possibility he left by daybreak, and that would have not given him enough time. We know that they were severely dehydrated because they had lost their stove. We know that Sandy Irvin was suffering from severe sunburn. We know that the ropes they had were both too short and too weak to allow them to belay down the second step.
Yet you write in your book that there is still room for speculation that Mallory might have indeed made it to the top. Why?
There's one possibility, because one thing that did happen in 1924 is that the expedition was absolutely battered by snowfall. Not once, but three times the expedition was pushed back from the base of the North Col by the sheer accumulation of snow. Now, they thought this was because of the lingering effects of the monsoon. We now know that, oddly, in 1924, there was this bizarre low-pressure system across the entire Karakoram, Hindu Kush, and the Himalaya that resulted in historic levels of snowfall. And had the snow accumulated on the northeast ridge as it did down below, it's quite possible that a kind of inclined plane was formed, essentially eliminating the impediment of the second step. And this, in fact, did happen in the fall of 1986, in which case Sandy Irvin and George Mallory could have walked over that impediment. And had they been able to get over the impediment of the second step, nothing would have kept George Mallory from getting to the top of Mount Everest.
You're listening to Wade Davis. He's the author of Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Were the Sherpas brought into this business, so to speak, by the Brits, or were the Sherpas climbing those mountains long before?
Oh, no, no. They would never have gone up a mountain. In telling the story in the book Into the Silence, I also tried very hard to tell the story of those early expeditions from the point of view of the Tibetans as well, sort of tell how the Tibetans saw these crazy mountaineers. And you see, for the Tibetan to go up on the slopes of a mountain and enter a zone where oxygen deprivation alone obliterates consciousness is about the silliest thing you can ever do, particularly with a precious incarnation. And so the Sherpa would never have, on their own, climbed these mountains. And what's interesting is Arthur Kellis, the man who died at Kampazong, the physiologist and physician, he had probably spent more time alone in the Himalaya than anyone at that period in history. And he had always gone with, quote-unquote, native companions. And it was he who first drew attention to the remarkable qualities of the Sherpas. And these qualities were, A, they were Buddhists, so they had a wonderful kind of magnanimous capacity to embrace hardship. They were physically very strong. They were entrepreneurial, very clever, and very devoted, and neither subservient nor were they bombastic and arrogant. So they just had a character that the British immediately recognized. But the training of the Sherpas and the birth of mountaineering in that tradition definitely happened in 1921. I mean, these were individuals who were equipped by the Brits and trained in ice techniques and rock techniques by Mallory and his cadre.
Now, as far as the oxygen is concerned, which you've mentioned once or twice, wasn't that a distinct accomplishment of the 1922 expedition, going up those mountains with supplemental
one
oxygen?
One of the fascinating debates that those back in London on the Everest Committee, which was a committee formed by members of the Royal Geographical Society and the Alpine Club, was whether or not using oxygen was sporting or not. And those who had never climbed anything higher than their desks tended to view it as being unsporting and un-British to use supplemental gas, whereas those on the expedition who knew the mountain and who understood science, particularly Howard Somerville, who was a doctor, and George Finch, who was a chemist, they viewed the use of supplemental oxygen as no more unsporting than seeking out the best possible pair of boots. And the British had made great strides in an understanding of the impact of high altitude, of course, during the First War, because every aviator had to have supplemental oxygen in the Royal Air Force. And so that research was applied to Everest. And in 1922, the whole plan was to test the efficacy of oxygen, and George Finch was the man who was going to do it. And in an incredible moment, he recruited to his colors Jeffrey Bruce, who was a cousin of General Bruce, who was leading the 1922 expedition, And Jeffrey had never been on a mountain in his life. And in 24 hours, Finch brought him up to speed on the oxygen apparatus. And then they climbed, and they climbed higher on the mountain and closer to the summit of the mountain by far than anyone before them. And had it not been for the fact that storms came in, forcing them to bivouac two nights in a row at an elevation beyond which any human being had ever imagined sleeping, and had it not been for George Finch saving the life of young Jeffrey Bruce, it's quite conceivable George Finch might have summited in 1922. He was a kind of another unsung, forgotten hero of the expedition.
So what was the reaction to Mallory's death, his disappearance and then an assumed death, and how old was he when he died?
Mallory was 38 years old when he died. I mean, the reaction was unbelievable. It's interesting because here, this was a war-stained nation. You know, I mean, in the first 2 years of peace, the economic agonies alone were such that more land exchanged hands than at any time since the Norman conquest. This is a land where 2 million parents had woken up to the realization they would never see their sons again. This is a land where there were still 70,000 men haunted in asylums from shell shock. There were, you know, 80,000 amputees, 65,000 men without sight. And yet, when Mallory disappeared, it literally caused a whole war-stained nation to weep. And there was a massive cathartic service in Westminster Cathedral, the first time and the only time a climber has ever been honored in that way.
How did the meaning of climbing Everest change over the years?
You know, what's fascinating about the whole Everest saga, in a way, if you go back through the whole sweep of it, before the war, it was sort of an adventure. It was, as I said, the sort of mission of redemption for an empire of explorers who had lost the race to the North Pole and the South Pole. In the wake of the war in the 1920s, it was sort of a mission of regeneration for a country that had been bled white by the war. And then, of course, 10 years later, there were four expeditions in the 1930s, all of which failed miserably, and they became kind of a symbol of the impotence of the declining British Empire on the eve of Hitler's war. And then finally, in 1953, when Hillary climbs a mountain, it becomes a sort of symbol of the final crack-up of the empire, in the sense that, you know, it wasn't someone from Oxford or Cambridge, it wasn't someone from the British elite, as the British had always anticipated, who would reach the top of the mountain. It was this unknown beekeeper from the frontier of empire, from New Zealand, plus his companion, Tenzin Norgay, who was a Sherpa. And critically, when Hillary refused to say to the press who got to the top first, we went together, that instantly elevated Norgay to national a hero status in India at the time, just in the wake of independence. And in a way, it reversed the whole notion of what it was to be a colonized person or, you know, a colony. And so Everest has always been this kind of touchstone by which you can measure both the height and the depth and the final breakup of the British Empire. In that way, I think it's such a powerfully symbolic place.
We thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest by Dr. Wade Davis. Wade, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Next week, Christopher Steiner, author of Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.